and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, it's Radio Free Thinker, episode 228, the Debating Islam edition. Today, this week, we have Randolph Richardson joining us to have a look at Islam. Say hello, Randolph.
Oh, hello.
And that's with an F, not a PH. So if you ever see PH, it's me. I screwed up. It's wrong. I'm bad. My apologies right now because I know it might occur.
Oh, thanks.
I'd like to start out today with a bit of a rant about micro-targeting. I was inspired by this talk because of the growing trend in our country that is leading us down a similar road as the U.S. Currently, the U.S. is closed, while a significant portion of the federal government is shut down. There is looming in the next week the fact that the U.S. may default on its bonds, i.e. its loans. This has never happened since the fall of the Roman Empire. Well, okay, it may have happened before, but not quite on the same magnitude. The U.S. dollar, for better or worse, is the foundational current of the foundational currency of the international financial system. It is this fact that no matter what economic catastrophe that may occur, even international bank failures, the greenback is still sort of the safest investment of choice. But that has been thrown out the window now. This is because you created sort of a hyper-partisanship in their particular Congress. So this is done because the politicians there feel that they have safe seats. They don't really have to listen to their constituents because they've figured out a way to get elected without actually having to listen to people. This has come to Canada, but in a slightly different form. We don't quite have the same gerrymandering you get in the U.S. We have a different thing, and this is where micro-targeting comes in. Most of the political parties now are spending much, much more money to find out about what the particular individual electorate are thinking. Not what they want, but what they're thinking. And then they use very precision ads to sort of single them out to get them to vote for their political party. It's kind of like the same thing you get when you go into the supermarket and you shop for food, right? The food companies aren't so much asking you, hey, what kind of foods do you like? It's they're sitting there saying, hey, we've got this and it's wonderful and you want to buy it because it's the best out there. And politicians are learning that very same trick. We noted on our show a few times that in the last federal election that Harper was making a lot of sort of special concessions to particular minority groups in an effort to sort of tweak them. On the CBC radio, they were making an analogy of about sort of three different kinds of theoretical families. One of them they had was, you know, sort of a middle-income worker at a Canadian Tire who liked to do lots of sports in their off time. And so instead of listening to him, so what does he care about? What does he want the government to do? It's like, oh, he's into sports, so we'll offer a discount on sporting good equipments for families. And so they kind of buy off the vote in that particular way. And you get the very same thing happening in a lot of other sort of areas. That's one of the main reasons that our last provincial election turned out to be such a from out of nowhere sort of thing is the BC Liberals weren't doing ads to appeal to people, as in, hey, folks, you got to love us. They were doing these sort of micro-targeting appeals that just basically say, oh, listen, you know, this brand is better than that brand, so I'm going to go for it. And it was a major upset. One of the major advisors to the Liberal Party had done the same thing for the Conservative Party in the previous election, and he was the only person who sort of said, hey, listen, the Liberals are going to win this easily because they're following this next strategy. And what I hate about it is that politicians no longer have to care about what you care about. They no longer have to worry about what do the people of Canada want. They've reduced you down to a commodity that they're just going to market. They're just going to try and convince you to buy their brand, and that's it, irrespective of actually doing any work for you. And I think that's a horrible thing to happen to this country.
Yeah, I think the political parties are looking more and more like corporations these days.
Yeah, actually, in many, many not good ways. So that was my rant, and if you have any comments or anything, please contact us at info@radiofreethinker.com. Any feedback on the show's format changes or any ideas for any topic ideas is welcome. So let's get into the whole idea of debating Islam. Okay, so now, as our loyal listeners know, I have described myself as a fundamentalist atheist. By that, I mean, perhaps uniquely, on one level, I think the concept of God rests on the supernatural, which I think is contradictory to reality. By definition, nothing supernatural can exist in a natural universe. Now, I don't mean this in sort of an ego-humanist way. There are likely entities in the universe that will appear godlike to me, sort of in the same way that, you know, modern man would appear godlike to prehistoric man. So it's not like, you know, there isn't something out there that can fool us, but these would still be natural entities. So if aliens came in and appeared godlike, they are still just biological beings. They're just advanced. And I'm also not saying that we as a species can know all that there is to know. There's likely much that we will never be able to know. And that said, there's still no room in this multiverse for supernatural entities known as gods. So agnostics, wake up, smell the coffee, and grow a pair. Even if you reject my rejection of the supernatural, the classic religions still fail to make the grade, and thus unequivocally we can deny their existence. So you can still be an atheist, a logical atheist, without having to feel, well, I want to sit in this sort of quasi-agnostic way. But again, I'm the fundamentalist here, you don't have to be. So this leads to the second adjective I often tend to describe myself, and that is evangelical. Evangelical in that I don't think it's good enough for me to just not believe in a God, but to actively resist the presence of religion in the world and to deconvert as many people as I can. In this effort to deconvert, I have discovered that I have a slight deficiency. I debate Christians with ease, having a wealth of knowledge about the Bible, the history of the faith, and its doctrines. I'm a little less easy while debating Judaism, but much of that knowledge comes from sort of Christianity, so there's sort of holdovers between the two. So I still have a solid, if less comprehensive, knowledge base to work from. However, when it comes to Islam, well, I just can never quite get my head around debating them. I mean, I do have a fairly good idea, fairly good knowledge of the history of Islam. However, the text of the Quran is pretty much beyond me. And more importantly, there's also so many supplementary texts that are almost as important to the faith as their primary text. There, of course, is another elephant in the room, and that, of course, is racism. When I debate a Christian, I don't really care if I offend them. Many of their beliefs are offensive. I should be able to do the same to Muslims, but we live in a complicated world. Part of the complexity comes from those atheists and Christians and Jews who don't see Islam as a religion, but as an ideology of hate, of terrorism. Now, they claim Islam is a religion of violence and savagery. Well, yes, it is. But so is Judaism, so is Christianity. And let's not leave out Sri Lankan Buddhists, who, as we speak, are murdering people in the name of ethnic purity. The texts were written centuries ago when violence and barbarity were considered normal. The vast majority of believers of any faith are, by and large, caring human people. Who would help someone who's sick, irrespective of that person's faith. So it's not like any one particular faith is in itself innately evil, although it is the root of evil. Human nature will always sort of win out to be more or less nice, but there are radicals out there. Now, it is true that the Muslim world, and by that, allow me to mean the expanded Middle East, i.e. from roughly China to the Atlantic, so, you know, Afghanistan all the way to Morocco. This expanded Middle East is at the heart of military and political turmoil. Much of that thanks to decades of dictators who have helped the world superpower control the region's strategic areas and, more importantly, their natural resources. So, is there more violence in the Middle East countries? Yes. But Muslim countries? Not so much. Indonesia boasts the largest number of Muslims in the world. They have 13% of the Muslims live there. And although it has its own different kinds of problems, it's not unstable and it's not overtly violent. In fact, if we go back to the 60s to the 70s, we could say the exact same thing about South and Central America, and perhaps claim that Catholicism is to blame. Liberation theology did play a key role in more than one of the revolutions in that area. Central America alone had sort of revolutionary movements, and we're talking death squads and terrorist-type acts, in every country, except perhaps Costa Rica. Costa Rica is kind of a weird country overall. Okay, so that explains the Middle East. But we recall that there were riots in Europe over the publication of a couple of cartoons. This must prove the sort of unique, extreme, violent nature of Islam. No. Again, more complicated than it may first appear. The largest number of immigrants to Europe come from the Muslim nations. These transient workers are actively sought by the host nations, but are little loved. In Canada, if you were born in Canada, you are Canadian. Not so in Europe, or most of Europe. You not only have to have been born of citizens, but sometimes many generations of citizens. And in the last couple of decades, many laws have been passed there to make it almost impossible for immigrants to become citizens. Recently, a number of laws have been passed in France, Switzerland, and all that, that has essentially tried to, I don't want to use, not ethnically cleanse, but to purify, no, to, what's the word I'm looking for here? To eliminate any cultural differences between the immigrants and the nation that they're going to. So things like banning the burqa and that sort of thing, wanting all of them to convert to good Christian faith or something of that nature.
Conformity.
Exactly. You know, so under this, the result of this is essentially a permanent underclass of poorly paid people with little to no prospect of any improvement. They are isolated and denigrated by the local culture. Into this powder keg, there are people who, of course, will seek personal power and aggrandizement. They will grab whatever is at hand to sort of stir the pot and ride that wave to greater glory. The people who are filling this vacuum and willing to ride that wave are often religious figures. We see that here in Canada and the United States especially, and it's no different in Europe and the Middle East. Now, of course, ironically enough, a lot of these people are not actually members of the local Muslim establishment because they kind of already have their power. These are people who are trying to move in on sort of new turf, and they are willing to grab whatever they can, like the offense, oh my, they drew a picture of Muhammad. And it's not so much religious anger, although that is the actual overt vision of it, but it's this political and social depravity that they had to suffer, this discrimination that they've had to suffer. That's the fuel. It's just the flame appears to be religious things. And again, it's not quite uniquely Islamic, but at the moment, they're the ones that are sort of at the focal point of the world's changing demographics. So why do we focus on Islam? So why do they focus on Islam or something else? Well, simply, it's the largest common denominator. Many people will come from Nigeria, from Turkey, from Somalia, but they're all Muslims. And in that way, it also helps create sort of a common identity that they can all call upon. And this is even more so when you have second or third generation, quote, immigrants who really don't know where they come from. All they know is that they have this one community. And the one thing that has kind of tied them all together is this concept of Islam and otherness. Now, of course, this condition is not helped by the fact that since 9/11, the West has the West's vilification of Islam has only helped isolate these communities and harden their faith as a shield against sort of the modern racism. Okay, so that said, Islam is like all other faiths, bullshit. So how does one debate a Muslim without being a racist? This has been something I thought was a big question. I had been toiling this over in my head for a long time because, I mean, when we sit back and we think about things like Richard Dawkins is not the most politic person when it comes to discussing Islam. Sam Harris, we've talked about on the show, is an Islamophobe, is definitely racist in a lot of things that he says. Basically, when he sits there and he says that, you know, anyone who is believes in the faith of Islam is innately a violent person because it is uniquely a violent faith. And again, on the one hand, yes, but they're all kind of innately violent if you dig down deep enough into them.
Yeah, but I don't see how, I don't see how that's a racist statement, though. That's a statement about the religion, right?
Well, but again, he's kind of, yeah, and this is another area where it almost harkens to anti-Semitism. But Jews are also not only a racial group, but they're also kind of a cultural group, so they do this meal. But the co-equivalence of one's faith with one's race, right? That he has literally lumped all Islams into be one people. Even though, as we have sort of, well, people will know, and I think we've discussed in the show, I mean, there are white Muslims, there are European Muslims, there are African Muslims, there are Asian Muslims. Mm-hmm. They're all Muslims, but they're not the same race. But by lumping them all together and treating them all the same, perhaps you could call it a religiousist. I'm trying to think of how you get ism and religious ism without sounding so. So
it's a group of people who all have the same belief. But, well, it's different from race, though.
Well,
race is something that people don't have control over, whereas belief they do.
True, but again, where it becomes slightly more complex is there is the assumption, again, erroneous, which is why it delves into the racist kind of sort of part of it, is it's assumed that all Muslims are Arab. I mean, that's just sort of the default. Now, logically, we know that's not true, but that is why anyone who is of darker skin and looks different, what was one of the big things with the recent attacks that had just gone on in Nairobi, was Sikh. Mm-hmm. Had the crap beat out of him because he looked like he was a Muslim. And it's that part that once you say, oh, he looks like a Muslim, that you're delving into the racism part, even though it is a faux racism. It's not a real racism.
Yeah, so in that case, I would think that they're using the religion as an excuse to not look racist, perhaps, to some degree.
Yeah. But again, so how go back to my original question.
Yeah.
How do you debate a Muslim without seeming like a racist? And again, I'd struggled this for a while, and it seemed, you know... And I asked one of my friends, and he actually said something that was so simple. It's like, yeah, of course, I'm stupid. He just said, well, when you debate them, just don't be that racist. Because as Randolph was just sort of pointing out, there is no innate racism to this unless you bring it into the conversation yourself.
Right. Yeah. If somebody from the KKK promoting the Aryan Nation was debating with a Muslim, then it's pretty easy to pull the race card in that case. But you know, when you're debating with an atheist. The atheist isn't doing this, then, you know, pulling the race card is more like a failure to debate properly. You know, you don't have a position, so you resort to these kind of attacks. That's the way I see it, when someone's pulling out the race card inappropriately.
Yeah, and you do get it on both sides to a certain degree. And again, I'm not quite sure how this will par out, but I'll say what it is, and then we'll figure out from there, that... If you do some criticism of Muslim nations, mm-hmm. they'll say, oh, you're an American imperialist or something like to that form. And in which case, you're kind of in this awkward little thing where, one, okay, the criticism is kind of valid. The U.S. is an imperial nation, but that's not the root of what I'm saying. And you quickly get sidelined into different things. So, you know, again, this concept of just don't be racist, it sounds simple enough. But to do that, first of all, we can't rely on the popular press, who far too often sort of defaults to this sort of racial suspicious argument sort of thing, right? So what do we need to understand is basically where does Islam come from? What are its fundamental beliefs? What are the types of Islams? And what are their faults in their belief? So first, we're going to go for a quick break. And when we return, we will talk about Islam, the faith, where it comes from, what it does.
CITR is proud to sponsor the Vancouver International Film Festival showing of Bill Morrison's film The Great Flood. Weaving together compelling archival footage of the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927, complemented by an original score by Bill Frisell. That flood led to an exodus of sharecroppers all heading north. The result? Chicago blues, rhythm and blues, and ultimately rock and roll. For showtimes and information, visit vif.org.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
And we're back. So we left off on the cliffhanger of what is Islam? So first, a quick history lesson. So it all started when Muhammad, a caravan trader, was visited by the angel Gabriel, as he's apt to visit people, I guess. Gabriel told Muhammad to start reciting the word of God. And this is where the idea that whatever Muhammad says is, or actually I shouldn't say whatever Muhammad says, because I guess there were times when he says, hey, I'd like a falafel, and that wasn't the word of God, that was just him being hungry. But by and large, everything he said is sort of treated as the word of God, literally just through his mouth, but from the guy upstairs. According to the faith, he apparently was reluctant to do this, but was encouraged by his family and clan. Again, one of the big things that comes out in the teachings of Islam is that Muhammad himself was very much worried that he would become the focus of the religion. One could think of, perhaps as a contemporary, is the idea of Jesus, where the worship of God somehow became secondary to the worship of Jesus, that the Christians managed to get around by saying, oh yeah, no, they're one and the same, so there's no conflict there.
Well, some do, and some believe they are separate. Yes. I've encountered both types.
Yes, although the one who apostates in the Catholic Church would hang them up. So anyhow, but like I say, so one of the things, that's why one of the reasons why you're not supposed to have any images of Muhammad is because they are worried that that will become the source of ideology, that you will worship the image of Muhammad and not the word of God. And
but I've seen art depicted from Islamic history where they're showing pictures of Muhammad.
What you would have saw is a human silhouette and the face all whited out. Or you would have seen some cloud, or you've never. There cannot be.
There was a face on those pictures.
No,
it was on one of these channels on TV. I don't remember something. One of those channels that they go over the history of different things.
Yeah,
not the History Channel, but
so
a different one.
Not in any of the standard Muslim faith.
Perhaps
All of the main sects see this as, and it's one of the things that is often mentioned by Muhammad himself as being really worried about this happening. In fact, the Quran itself only mentions Muhammad apparently 4 times, although everything is assuming to be alluding to Muhammad in some way, and ergo through him to Allah, and that's the whole thing.
And the restriction on the picture seems to match one of the 10 commandments too.
Yes.
About not making graven images of God.
Right.
So this time it's a prophet.
we'll talk a bit more about where Islam stands in the evolution of Abraham's faith. The Arabian Peninsula also was the home of many religions. There were many pantheists, like Babylonians, Assyrians, Mesopotamians, even you had Greek and Romans, as well as some classic monotheisms, such as Zoroastrianism, Judaism, and, of course, Christianity. Each tribe had their own gods and religious artifacts. These were collected in special buildings called kabahs. They were politically important because in these places, no fighting was allowed. It was forbidden to have any sort of violence there. And this sort of allowed groups to sort of meet together in a place of peace to sort of talk things out. A lot of the tribes were constantly at battle over each other, over one thing or another. It's very hard for us in North America to relate of the importance of water and oases and wells in this particular area, but literally it was life and death. If you want to get a good idea of what it would be like, sort of think of Doom and the whole, Fremen and all that, right? So they were constantly fighting. So these kabahs were really important places where people could meet up and work things out, at least temporarily. It was also economically important because of these sort of bubbles of peace, trade could be done. And really, that was the most important activity that was going on in Arabia. What made Mecca important was first, this was sort of Muhammad's hometown, right? Perhaps more important, its Kaaba held a rock that apparently had fallen from heaven. We call these, of course, now meteorites. And apparently, it was the Kaaba was made by Abraham. And a lot of these religions try and pull back on the history to try and give themselves legitimacy. But to be fair, in this particular day and time, a rock that had literally fallen from heaven would have been a pretty special thing to have around. That doesn't happen that often. Anyhow, pardon me. Radical reforming religions, and Islam was one of them, sort of in the same way that Moses and Jesus had sort of attempted to return the people back to the, quote, true faith, Muhammad was just another prophet given this task. In his role as radical, he destroyed the clan system of identity and replaced it with sort of a religious identity. So instead of identifying yourself with your clan or your tribe, you now identified yourself with the religion, and we were all Muslims, and therefore we can't kill each other. And, for many people, this was actually a very positive thing to happen in their life, irrespective of the whole Allah thing. Of course, this was met with resistance, and first of many wars were waged. First to destroy the Mohammedans, and then the Muslims to, quote, spread the faith as we might recast them as empire builders. So Muhammad was forced into exile, and he went to Medea, which was, again, sort of his second home from home. And then, of course, he returned and conquered. Now, of course, monotheism is not unique in the area, but what But what was so that's the word I'm trying to think of here. So the idea of monotheism isn't really unique, but its placement above the tribal areas did make it very, very unique. And as a result, you know, it changed the whole way the Arab people sort of dealt with themselves. And that had a big thing, because kind of think about when the early Alfred the Great, I guess it would be, went around and unified all the tribes of England to create the nation of England. When you were small tribes and you're fighting yourself, you are all weak. But when you unite yourself into one big one, then you become a power to be reckoned with. When Muhammad came back, and like I say, he eventually reconquered Mecca, this was a big deal. How big? Well, it's from this action that Muslims mark year one of their calendar. He also shifted the focus of prayer away from Jerusalem, because let us remember, Islam is part of the Abrahamic religions, which were normally focused on Jerusalem, and now the prayer was focused on Mecca. I see this move as kind of like McCarthy during World War II in the Philippines when he says, I will return. Well, Muhammad had his eyes in Mecca, and he would return, and then he did return. And, well, it was a big thing for the movement. And I'm getting bogged down on this. So let's continue on, jumping ahead a little bit. So one of the things that kind of separated him from the Jesus sort of thing was that he was actually quite a good
Warrior,
exactly. So Islam was not only a force to be reckoned with religiously, but it had become a force to be reckoned with militarily. And there's also another important thing, too, is that there was no real separation between civic and religious duty. There was no sort of Jesus sitting there, render unto Caesar what is Caesar. It was all everything under Allah, period. When Muhammad died, there was sort of no need for a religious successor. Muhammad, after all, was the last prophet, and there was going to be no more. But, of course, he had created this empire, and there was need for a political successor. The first was Muhammad's father-in-law, which was controversial because some thought it should be Muhammad's son-in-law, who was the fourth leader, and this dispute, however, is rooted in one of the great divides in Islam. This divide eventually led to the split of Islam into Sunni and Shiite, and then eventually Sufi. The Sunnis, like the father-in-law, the Shiites, the son-in-law, the Shiites believe, among other things, that Muhammad's selected his son-in-law to be the successor. Sunnis deny this and hold that the successor was to be elected, and Muhammad's father-in-law won. Make no never mind that the son-in-law was eventually elected as the fourth successor. This divide continues to this day and is one of the fundamental points of conflict in the Middle East. Like right now, Syria, one of the big things that amplifies the tensions going on there, above and beyond, obviously, a horrible dictator and inequality, is Syria is run by a Shiite belief people. I can't remember the name of the party. They are supported by Iran, who is, again, the other big sort of Shiite. And opposing them are the Saudi Arabians and the Iraq, basically all the Sunnis in there. And this religious tension is a major part of the conflict that's going on there. Now, I also mentioned Sufis. Sufis, we don't think of too much. They're actually a very small minority, but they're kind of the cool ones because they sort of believe that, you know, you need to be more spiritual. And one of the ways to do that is to become physically active. And in doing so, you become closer to God. So if you ever heard of the whirling dervish, these are the people who sit there and they've got, look like these big dress or cloaks, and they spin around in really complicated and frantic dances, and they try to get themselves into sort of this trance state so they can come closer to gods. So those are sort of the three big divides. Now, it was important for the growth of the Islamic Empire is that it was between two large existing empires, the Byzantine and the Safavid Persian Empire, sort of. Not quite, but think of it as Persian for our simple Western sort of ideas. And as so these two empires, and these two were sort of major trading areas between China and the Far East, as well as the prosperous and growing markets of Europe. And of course, timing is everything. The Byzantine South Empires had spent centuries fighting each other and were worn down and weakened sort of by the time Islam hit the scene, thus aiding the rapid growth of the Islamic Empire. So Islam eventually created a vast empire stretching from India to Spain. Of course, Muslims believe Muhammad is the final prophet, that Abraham, Moses, and Jesus were prophets, but the Quran, as the supposed word of Muhammad, is not written from the perspective of a person, which kind of the other ones were, you know, sort of think of Book of John, you know, it's John's vision of what happened, but literally from the Book of God. This is the Word of God literally written down here. And some Christians would argue that the Bible is the literal Word of God, but it's written from a perspective of a person, so it doesn't quite hold. Anyhow, there are five main pillars of Islam, so the main five main pillars of Islam. There is the Shahada, or Ash-Shahada, and that is sort of, you know, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. So, you know, essentially, you know, just believe in one God, monotheism, period. The Salat, or ritual prayer, five times a day, obligatory to everyone except for the young, the sick, and the menstruating, which, you know, all religions also seem to be sexist at some point or another. It's not uniquely Islamic, although, again, because of historical coincidence, they do seem to be pushing it farther than most. Although there are some Christian sects, think Mormons, that are probably running neck and tail as far as being as denigrated of textually, anyhow.
Misogynistic?
Yeah, that would be a good word. So there's also the Sawam. This is the month-long fasting during Ramadan, where you're not allowed to eat during the day, which I actually was thinking about that, considering these people sort of grew up in an Arab area where you basically wanted to sleep most of the day away because it's too friggin' hot to be out there anyhow. I'm not sure how much of a sacrifice this was, but most religious things are symbolic gimme, so, you know, yeah, okay, so, sure. There's the Zakat, or almsgiving, or kind of tithing. This gets a little bit more complicated. So this is where you have to give a portion of your wealth to the poor or to the church. Now, when I was reading before the show, there was some debate about whether you're supposed to give money to Allah, i.e. sort of the Muslim churches, mosques, sorry, or whether you give it to sort of Islamic organizations, kind of like the Red Crescent or something like that, who would sort of help out the poor and help out the needy, which means one sort of being support your clerics and help them feed themselves and live in a nice place, and the other one is help the poor who can't really help themselves. So there's some debate about that. But again, tithing, giving to the poor, a common theme amongst most of these sort of religions. And of course, there's the Hajjah. And this is where once in your lifetime, you must make a pilgrimage to Mecca, if you can, which again, it's like, oh, you have to, well, if you can, so it's a bit of, but anyhow, it's kind of cool. It gives you a great excuse to kind of go out and travel the world and see what the world is like, right? Okay, so that's sort of the very rough history of Islam. My apologies for some sputters there, but you get the idea that, you know, this was a micro sort of religion that exploded at the right place, at the right time, under the right conditions, and bam. And once it had created this huge empire, notably again between the Far East and Europe, it became a really rich and wealthy nation. Rich and wealthy nations also tend to be powerful with big navies, good armies, and it worked for them quite well. Unfortunately, there was some issues with the Crusades, and like any empire, after an amount of time, there's decay. In fact, though, many people may not quite realize this, but the caliphate, or again, the religious Muslim empire, existed right up until 1918, I think it was, with the end of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was a caliphate, and it was sort of the last vestige of the Mohammedan empires. Any thoughts on that? We're going to go off to a quick break, but Randolph? He hates when I put him on the spot like this. I'm so sorry.
No, I don't have anything to say right now. I'm sorry.
Then we will go to commercial.
Let's do the break first, yeah.
Media Democracy Days presents their fifth annual fundraising Concert Democracy Loud, taking place Thursday, October 17th in 2013 at the Railway Club, doors at 8 p.m. Funds raised go to support media reform and democratization in Canada. The event features three local bands and great prizes. Tickets are $10. For more information, visit therailwayclub.com and look under events.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
And we're back. So we sort of talked a brief history about the... we did a brief summary about the history of Islam.
Yeah.
Now, Islam lacks some of the innate faults of Christianity. Notably, Jesus was a Jew. And thus, not only is the New Testament sort of available for us to sort of tear apart, but we also have the Old Testament as well, because again, this following this tradition. Muhammad traces his faith directly to Abraham, but it's not sort of tainted with the other manifestations of the Abrahamic religions, i.e. Christianity and Judaism. So if one points out a logical fallacy or inconsistency in Leviticus, Muslims just get to say, well, yeah, no, they got it wrong. That's the whole reason why Muhammad came here, was to correct all that screw-ups they made before. And that Muhammad's message is the last true message. I think the most fundamental tenet of Muslims that proves to them God is real is the worship of the text of the Quran. And I'm going to use that word worship of the text because, one, it's offensive, it's meant to be, but it also shows a bit of the hypocrisy because they see the text as the perfect, unchanging word of Allah.
Well, when it's in Arabic.
Yeah. When it's in Arabic. Important point to make up.
Yeah.
So, and again, they hold that it has not changed at all from day one, from the word onto the paper, and that was all. When asked about Islamic miracles, you know, like we'd seen with Moses and Jesus, the Muslims will respond that the Quran itself is their foundational miracle. Now, it was not until his death, well, actually 652-ish, about 20 years after his death, and in following the Jesus tradition, that an effort was made to write down and codify what Muhammad had said. Likely similar to historical Jesus, Muhammad was probably illiterate, and thus there's no actual literal writings of Muhammad, only what the people remember him saying. This leads, of course, to some problems. If Muhammad was illiterate, and don't get me wrong, this is not a denigration. Arab culture at the time was an oral tradition, and it was not, you know, not weird for someone to be illiterate in this particular area. There was actually a complete caste of people whose job it was to memorize the word of Muhammad and essentially be walking Qurans. It was not until his death and the killing of almost 1,000 of these human Qurans that an effort was actually made to write down, to create a written Quran. This task was given to Zayed ibn Tabib, who collected what scraps of written text there were available and consulted with, quote, learned men who either memorized the text or personally knew Muhammad. So the perfect word was not actually Muhammad, but it was sort of Zayed's belief to what the authentic quotes were from these people that remembered what they did or the scraps that he thought were real as opposed to ones that, you know, he sort of filtered through and said, no, I don't really think this. So in this sense, I don't really see a miracle any more than I would see in the miracle of Book of John or the Q doctrine, which is the sort of root text of a couple of the books of the Bible that they think was written more or less right after Jesus had died, assuming Jesus really existed, but I won't get into that right now. Mm-hmm. We do know Muhammad existed. That's one step up he has over Jesus.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty well known. And
yeah, but the fact that, you know, that the Quran itself was collected after his death, they were filtered by this one particular person, and things that he thought were true just leads it open to sort of, you know, inconsistencies and incongruities. And let us not forget that this is not happening in isolation, that there had been a lot of doctrinal debates in the Christianity about inconsistencies and contradictions in the Christian text. Mm-hmm. And if I'm sitting there and I'm writing a new Bible, i.e. we'll call it the Quran, and even let's say that I'm trying to be as authentic as I can, if I came across two lines of text that seem to contradict each other, I would say, oh, this happened over here in the Bible, so that must be a bad thing, so I'm not going to let it happen here. So we're going to filter out one or the other so that we have the true word and we don't have to worry about these pesky contradictions that seem to rise in other faces.
Yeah, you've got a competitor, so you want to do better than your competitor for sure.
Exactly.
And assume that's what's going to happen. Right.
And that's an odd sort of thing. I mean, a lot of people sort of comment how the New Testament is such a much nicer, more caring sort of document over the Old Testament. And that's because, well, like, they had some time to think things over and they said, hey, we could probably do a slightly better job. So version 2 is always better than version 1, and the Quran gets to be version 3. Oddly enough, the oldest surviving Quran that we know of dates to about 700 AD, which again puts it about a generation or three after Muhammad actually lived. So again, there's a lot of to say it's the original word of Muhammad is a stretch at best, and none of the original strips or texts that I could find exist at all. So even the scraps that he originally derived some of these texts from don't exist. And then it gets worse. Beyond the Quran, there is the Hadith, which are sayings and stories attributed to Muhammad, but whose sources are widely variable. So this is not so much the word of Muhammad writ large, but these are things that people sort of heard or they thought about Muhammad and are sort of treated as special but not godly. Some things are sort of, you know, very likely to be true. Sort of something he said to his sister, and they asked his sister, hey, what did he say? And she said, oh, he said this. It's like, okay, so this is really good. Others are going to be like, well, I heard Fred told John, who knew Jerry, whose sister apparently overheard Muhammad say something, those kind of things, which are still sort of recorded, but are not given a lot of weight.
There could be changes to the context around those quotes as well. It's,
exactly, and that's assuming that,
today.
Yeah.
With Albert Einstein, they misquote. He gets misquoted quite a bit, even.
Yeah. Well, actually, a great example of this is the whole, you know, 72 virgins awaiting martyrs in heaven.
I've heard different numbers, by the way, but 72 seems to be the common one.
Well, no, and actually, that's an excellent point to bring up, because depending on where you're reading it, first of all, this whole virgins thing isn't so much directed towards martyrs, but when you go to heaven, there is sort of a sensual paradise that awaits you,
yeah.
Right? And some say it's 6, some say it's 72, some say other numbers, some don't give numbers at all. Although, ironically enough, women only get one man. That's supposed to be good enough for you. Mm-hmm. But again, this whole idea, you know, sort of the 17 virgins and all that, most contemporary Muslims don't believe that at all. It's like, yes, it's in the text, but that's part of the thing that's supposed to be more allegory. It's not literal, and you know, you can't take it. Mm-hmm. So it's not given a lot of weight. Each of the main sects of Islam follow a different hadith collection. So again, these collections, and some of it are also what they call Islamic jurisprudence. So it is interpretations of what the word is supposed to mean. And actually, there's a special word for that I mentioned later on. But each one has sort of their own version of this hadith. So again, to say that this is the unfailing, absolute truth, unchanging word of Allah just doesn't seem to be all truth, especially when a lot of these secondary texts were written anywhere from 100 to 400 years after Muhammad's death. Now, from here, it becomes a little difficult, because if we go looking for contradictions and fallacies in the Quran, often the hadith is included. So when you try and look up a quote from Quran, it may be from the quote Quran, but it may be from one of these subtexts that makes reference to the Quran. And for us simple European type people, it's weird. It's kind of like
it's complicated.
Making reference, I guess, to the Torah in some ways. And even that is, I think, more simple, because you have a lot of rabbinic texts that, again, are sort of their legal interpretations of what the Old Testament says. And they're sometimes considered to be canonical, sometimes not. Right. So if we remember things like the Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie, and this is still another point to prove that, you know, this is not the perfect unchanging word, which is based upon apparently a part of Muhammad's verse, which were either edited out or lost, that make reference to Satan. And I don't want to go into Salman Rushdie's issues at all, but there is enough secondary reference to this in the Tifsir, or these are the teaching texts, which sort of explain or aid how we're supposed to understand the Quran. There's enough mentions of this particular text in it to make most scholars believe that it did exist and it was there, but it is no longer there. So the fundamental claim of the perfection of the word of Allah seems to be false. But they make other claims as well, and these sound a bit more familiar to our ears. Any thoughts on that so far? Perfect word of Allah.
You know, when I've been talking to various Muslims about this over the past few years, I ask about the reliability with this, with these different translations that have come about. And the immediate reaction that I always get is that these aren't the real translations. And the problem with translation is that it isn't the real word of Allah. And it always goes back to having to learn Arabic so that you can study the Quran, the original Quran. They all refer to this original Quran. But, you know, for us, you know, we don't speak Arabic, so we're relying on these translations that are available.
Well, what makes it even...
So how do we know which is the best one to follow is what it starts to turn into.
Well, and another irony that plays into this is that Arabic itself, the written language, changed because of the Quran, that they were finding that some people were pronouncing certain words differently, whether you were in Persia or whether you were in Turkey or in Morocco. Mm-hmm. So whenever you see Arabic writing and you sometimes see dots above and below the line, those didn't exist when Muhammad was alive. Oh. These were sort of a creation to help sort of codify and clarify certain pronunciations of words to, again, make sure it doesn't ever change, although that in itself was a change. Now, much of what I'm going to say next is based upon a website called Islam and Science. So some people may say these are red herrings, and maybe they are, but it gives you a bit of an idea of where a debate might go if you're talking to someone who is a Muslim. So let's start off. One of the main arguments is sort of the cosmological argument, and I'll quote their version of it. If there's a creation, there must be a creator. If there's a creator, he must be the sustainer. This is a new one for me. The creator cannot create himself. If he is the sole creator / sustainer, he must be one. God must be one. Otherwise, he would see great differences in competition between the gods if there were more than one. So he is alone. Now, again, the whole issue of, well, if he doesn't need a creator, then why does the universe need a creator? If he can just appear out of nothing, then, or has always been.
Well, this is the old classic logical problem of infinite regress. And the same thing happens with other religions that have creator deities as well. So, you end up just going around in circles. And and sometimes it turns into a debate, well, expectation that people on the opposing side are accused of claiming that everything came from nothing, which also has its problems.
You know, there's one thing, again, that I haven't heard in this sort of cosmological argument that you hear from typical Christians, is the idea, well, you know, if there was more than one God, they'd be fighting. And you'd see chaos.
They would be, but why would they be?
So that's one argument.
Not all husbands and wives fight. As an example.
Well,
and they create children.
Okay. But one could... Oh, so,
I'm
yes.
being pedantic.
No, no. But yeah. that's a good point. I was going to go a slightly different route, is that, you know, if there were a bunch of gods in the universe, you know, then there'd be, like, turmoil and fighting, and there'd be wars between religions.
Because the universe just isn't big enough.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, there is war between religions. So maybe if you thought of Allah as one god and Yahweh as another god, that might explain the Middle East.
Well, but you even alluded to the wars between the Sunni and the Shiites. And, you know, it's one Muslim I was talking to recently was telling me that his parents, one, the father or mother, one's a Shiite and one's a Sunni. And when he goes to pray in the mosque, one of them prays with the hands on their side, hands down, and the other one prays with hands on their chest. So he'll purposely do the opposite, and he'll catch a lot of flack for it. Here in Canada, you know, he's pretty safe to do this, I think. But you know, there are some places where the war is so strong between different sects within the same religions, and this is, and Islam isn't unique to this. That, you know, he'd be in some pretty major trouble if he was doing this in some of those more hostile environments, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, again, going with that whole, you know, hostile cultures, it is a coincidence, I think, of history that Islam has more of these fundamentalist nations. But if you're in Uganda or something like that, you know, you get a lot of this sort of, it's my religion or no religion at all. I mean, Nigeria is famous for a lot of intersect warfare.
It's a bifurcated view. It's very black and white. You probably heard, I remember hearing this term a lot when I was a kid, when the televangelists were causing a lot of controversy, and in the U.S. particularly. And it seems that it's almost like some people are imposing an expectation that you must pick one or the other. There's nothing, no gray area in between. So, yeah.
Oops. So, So the cosmological argument, really no different than what we are used to debating with regards to Christians. So that's good. Now, there's also the teleological argument. I'm hoping I get my ologies kind of right. But they did have sort of a new one. So teleological argument is everything was sort of created with a purpose, that nothing happened just by accident. So they had, like I say, they threw a new one. I hadn't heard this one before. So again, quoting from them. What if the scientist's medical theory, he claims that a gas leaks in a pharmacy warehouse causing a terrific explosion. All the different chemicals and substances just smash into each other in the correct amounts to produce a miracle drug that cures everything from cancer to heart disease and liver disease, old age and warts. Wait, there's even more on this one. It is also, it is all in one formula, packaged in a bottle with labels and ready to go with no mess left on the floor. Which, of course, is just a complete misunderstanding of how evolution in the macro works. Everyone thinks, well, you know, animals evolved by accident. And it's not. Evolution is a directed process, but it's directed by survival, right? So, you know, with a little bit of change over a long period of time, kind of what they said would happen, could sort of happen, but it's not just throw this big mess and it somehow miraculously appears as one thing. And it kind of goes on with the idea that, you know, if you found a watch on the beach, to quote again another famous example, you would not assume it was just natural. You would assume there was a watchmaker.
Yeah.
And again...
But that would still be an assumption, but it would be a correct one.
Yeah. But it also, it denies the fact that we are not really watches. I mean, one thing that comes to my mind is that...
We're organic.
And you have an example of this. You have a child, yeah. Right? Did you plan out the child? Were you there building it cell by cell so that, you know, it would be exactly what your child is now?
No, both of them actually, my wife and I, we actually didn't even want to know the sex before they're born. And it was quite a delight later on telling our children. They surprised us when they were born. They're very happy to hear this. Yep. At age 5 and 6. They love hearing stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Important message here is they're not an accident. But there's a lot of coincidental and even accidental things that happen throughout the growth stage that get us to where we are.
Exactly. So again, yeah. Natural,
very unintentional,
directed,
things.
Yeah. But natural. And there's no need, you didn't need a creator.
We direct them to eat their vegetables so they can grow better. Yeah.
So when it comes to evolution, they do a bit of a sidestep. And this is where they are sort of both creationist and Darwinist kind of at the same time. So they hold, of course, that Allah created the universe. And from that, he also created animals and plants, etc. But these animals can change over time. So evolution is kind of possible. Well, actually, it's more intelligent design because they think that God is the actual one who does the changing. Mm-hmm. But if you do talk to a number of Muslims and you exclude humans from it, they will sit there and say, oh, yes, you know, whales evolved from some other animal, that there were dinosaurs at one point. And none of that conflicts with their faith because there is this little area where they're allowed to sort of have natural science in their faith for most of the universe. Although, again, strict textual doctrinists will say no, but we're going to go with the average people who say sort of yes. But they do hold that humans are a special creation and that they can't change. And actually, this is maybe somewhat of so we are humans are unique creations and we are made in God's image. Allah created us out of us. He created women, and out of both of us, he created the human race. So again, they basically go back to the Adam and Eve story.
Yeah, sounds
and they,
just like
and they stick with that.
Yeah,
and they actively reject the fact that humans may have any common ancestor with apes or fish or anything like that. And they again will actively, you know, where they're willing to accept the genetics of evolving butterflies. They refuse to accept it for humans. And again, only because they have this sort of special qualification that, again, they're not allowed to, which doesn't hold up to reason. So again, these so far have been pretty weak arguments to smack down. Now, when I was actually reading about this one, I read one thing, and this may be a fringe idea for this one particular website or not, but they stated that the soul leaves the body on two occasions. Obviously, it leaves the soul when you die. That's pretty standard for any of these sort of faiths.
Yeah.
But they also state that every night when you fall asleep, an angel comes down, packs up your soul, takes it to heaven. When you wake up, it brings it back, puts it back in your body. And there's so much...
What the angel does with it?
I play bocce ball or something. I don't know. But again, that struck me as a pretty weird idea, and I never heard that before. So if I have any Muslim listeners, please... one, is this idea... common, and two, why?
It actually reminds me of something I read about Asatru, which is kind of the putting together the Norse mythology with Thor and Odin and the other deities from that time, where they had a similar kind of concept. So it's where you get drunk as a feigning ritual so that the gods could borrow your sobriety and actually do things.
Oh.
I'm surprised it's not more popular in universities, actually.
So another major technique of Muslims in defending their faith is to claim that Muhammad knew things that were only recently discovered. So first is that the universe had its origin in, quote, smoke, that the heavens and earth are made of the same stuff. As Carl Sagan famously said, we are all made of stardust. Mm-hmm. So a win for them. Not quite. First, as already mentioned, they have already sort of debunked the scientific cosmology when they said the universe was created by Allah.
Yeah.
So you can't really have it both ways. Hey, either science is real and you got to accept all what it says, or it's not, in which case you can't use it to defend your own particular pet things.
Mm-hmm. Position, yeah.
Yeah, this the same proofs. Yeah, sorry. So again, you know, they do a lot of this. I think it's almost called gish galloping. I think we've come to it, where they will point to these little sort of textual things and say, ah, you could interpret this to mean that. And if you've done any research into Nostradamus, these people do the same thing all of the time. They also point out that Muhammad said, quote, "Have you not seen how God makes the clouds move gently, then joins them together, then makes them into a stack, and then you see the rain comes out of it, and he has sent down hail from the mountains in the sky, and he strikes with it whoever he wills, and turns it into whomever it wills, and vivid flashes of lightning nearly blind the sight. See, he knew more about meteorology than we did like 50 or 100 years ago." But of course, this is only if you really take what he says sort of out of context and you warp it a bit, because again, there are no mountains up there. We know how it. There's no sense that he had any idea what electricity was. Yes, clouds form and they build up, and then rain comes out of them. That's something that's been really known for like thousands of years, right? I mean, yeah. We said, you know, the thunder god may be behind it. So, I guess now it's time. Oh yeah, so they also do similar things for aquatic confluences where waters meet up, the zygote, the cerebellum, again, they're basically quote mining the Quran and twisting them in such a bizarre way. So it's contradiction time. So is it okay to drink alcohol? Yes, according to the Quran 16:67, and the fruits of the date palm and grapes, and whence ye derive strong drink and good nourishment, lo, therein is indeed a potent for the people who have sense. No. 2:219. Strong drink and games of chance, say, in both is a great sin. Is each person free to believe what he or she wishes? Yes. 2:256. There is no compulsion in religion. Yes. 18:29. Whoever wills, let him believe, and whoever will, let him disbelieve. No. We have prepared for the disbelievers fire. It tent encloses them. If they ask for a shower, they will be showered with water like molten lead that burneth their faces. Calamitous the drink, and ill is the resting place. No, 4:89. They long that ye should disbelieve even as they disbelieve, and then them kill them wherever ye find them. So, yeah, you don't have to believe in us, but if you don't, you're gonna burn. And then, of course, the last one I'm going to have is, who was the first Muslim? This varies. Abraham or Jacob, according to 2:132. The same did Abraham enjoin upon his sons and also Jacob, saying, O my sons, lo, Allah hath chosen for you the true religion. Therein dieth not save as man who has surrendered unto him. Then there's Moses, 7:143. And Moses fell down senseless. And then he woke, saying, Glory unto thee, I turn unto thee repentant. I am the first of the true believers. Then, of course, Muhammad, 39:12. And I, Muhammad, I'm commanded to be the first of those who are Muslims. Surrender unto him. So really a mixed bag. And we see that Islamic religion, like all other religions, are just based on a bunch of poop, for lack of a better word, and they're not hard to debate. You just got to get around their gish galloping and really poor sense of science, which is encouraged in the faith, like in all other faiths.
Yeah, it's just, you know, stick to the issues, and I think you're in good shape, right?
So, Time to say goodbye?
Okay, goodbye. Thank you for having me on.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. Cosmos.